Greetings. You're now listening to the most handsome and intellectually superior specimens on Earth. I could be wrong, but I doubt it. Starts now.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever time of day it is where you are. We hope that you're doing well. We're pleased to be able to bring you another episode of I Could Be Wrong, But I Doubt It. My name is Fresh, and we're thankful that you decided to join us today. Before we get to this week's episode, I'd like to remind you that if you like what you hear, to please go to Apple Podcasts and rate our podcast and leave us a comment. The podcast is now available on Google Play, Spotify, CastBox, and Stitcher, with more outlets to come in the future. You can also connect with us on our social media platforms on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook at ICBW Podcast. That's at ICBW Podcast. Be sure to like, comment, follow, and subscribe. You can also check us out on our website at ICBWPodcast.com. That is ICBWPodcast.com. You can also type in I could be wrong, but I doubt it.com, and it'll take you to the same spot. And check this out. We're still picking random listeners on a weekly basis for the remainder of 2018, who leave comments and rate us on Apple Podcasts or connect with us on social media and share our content as well. The winners will get a prize pack that includes one of our t-shirts and some other merchandise that I know you're going to love, because as I always say, I will not give you shit that you can't use. Now, without further delay, let's get this thing rolling. Today, we're pleased to welcome our guest who is involved in a major political and legislative milestone that I think as many people as possible need to hear about. We are honored to be one outlet of many that we hope will highlight and spread this message across our community, and also highlight the leadership of this extraordinary young man. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome a gentleman who is the chair of the Pennsylvania Legislative Black Caucus. He's a trustee at Millersville University. He's a champion of education reform and criminal justice reform. It is my distinct pleasure to introduce the Honorable Jordan Harris, State Representative for District 186 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Representative Harris, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me.
Man, we appreciate you taking the time to bless our podcast with your presence. We're really excited to have you today, and we know that you have a lot of information that you want to give out to the community, and especially the constituents of the district that you serve. So, without any further delay, let's just get right into it, man. Can you give us some brief background information about yourself?
Sure. So I was born and raised in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I'm a product of a single parent household, but I was blessed because my grandmother, my mother's mother, lived directly across the street from me. And I was also blessed because, you know, although my father wasn't in the household, you know, I definitely do have and had a relationship with my father and my father's side of the family. But growing up, it was me and my mother. And I went through public school my whole 12 years. Went to a public university in Pennsylvania, that being Millersville University, to get my undergrad degree. And, I grew up with kind of meager beginnings. I mean, we weren't well off. And at many points in my childhood, we weren't even middle class. But my mother did all that she could to ensure that I was active and that I was involved in different things, and that, I was exposed to as much as she could expose me to.
So growing up through, you said meager beginnings or whatnot, what was the inspiration for you to become involved in politics? Because that's, normally when you look at how society relates to politicians, there's always a kind of like an aristocracy type of view. Like, you're coming from this level of socioeconomic status and you kind of catapult into the political realm. So growing up like you grew up, what was the fire that, where was that lit? Where was that fire lit to get you into politics? Because some of the things that you've done are so extraordinary in such a short period of time. Where did that come from? Where did that drive come from?
Sure. So I would always say that first and foremost, my dedication and drive comes from my grandmother. My grandmother had three children, raising them in the projects in South Philadelphia when she made the decision to work during the day and go to community college in Philadelphia after she finished work. And she would continue to do that and finish community college with an associate's degree and then go on to Temple University and get a bachelor's degree in education and taught for 32 years in a Philadelphia school system.
Okay.
So I think first and foremost, my dedication comes from my grandmother and my desire to kind of move people forward, I would think, comes from my upbringing in the, you know, Senator Hardy Williams School of Politics. Senator Hardy Williams was one of the first African-Americans in Philadelphia to win a seat in the legislature against the party. He's considered the father of independent Black politics. And for me, when I look at examples like him, his son, who's current State Senator Anthony Williams, and the folks that I've kind of been around politically, it's always been about the empowerment of people. It's always been about the liberation of people. It's never been about what you can get or what you can gain, but how do you use politics to empower and liberate people? So when I look at, you know, what I'm doing, and it kind of shows in the work that I do and the areas that I advocate for, it's always about empowering people and leveling the playing field.
Right, right. That's so refreshing to hear, because you see so many politicians that look at their political plight in such a micro perspective, and it's good to hear that someone is genuinely concerned about the macro, about the whole in entire community moving forward. That is definitely refreshing. And as mentioned before, you serve District 186 of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Can you give us some of the demographics of your particular district?
Sure. My district is a very diverse district, racially, ethnically, economically. I tell people all the time, I have $50,000 homes and $5 million homes all in the same district. I have people with some of the highest degrees from some of the most prestigious universities in the world to those who are going back to school to get their GED. I have, you know, folks who have served time, and I have the prosecutors who put them in jail.
Wow.
All living in the very same district.
Wow. Wow.
So, you know, it is majority African-American, about 60% African-American.
Mm-hmm.
I have a very large Asian-American population. So I have a Cambodian, a Vietnamese population, a Laotian population that's growing in my district. A small Hispanic population that's growing as well in the district. So all of that is in my district. And I am bordered by the University of Pennsylvania, Drexel University. I'm bordered by Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and all of these other things. So it's a great district to represent, but the issues and the concerns of the district can be vary. But I think at the core, we all want the same thing, which is good schools, safe streets, and the ability for everybody to be mobile as far as socioeconomically.
Right, right. And you kind of touched on my next question. Just wanted to ask, are there any issues that are specific to your district? Or should I say, are there any specific issues that your district cares about more than others? Are there any type of hot buttons that constantly come up that you find yourself having to constantly address in the way that you participate, legislatively?
Sure. I mean, education is definitely important in my district. Gun violence and employment are all important. Philadelphia as a city has 25.7% rate of poverty. In my district, that is about 25% of my folks living in poverty. In
wow.
the city, half of the folks who live in poverty live in deep poverty. So according to the federal guidelines, one person making $16,000 a year is a person living in poverty. One person making $8,000 a year is living in deep poverty.
Wow.
And you add $4,000 to that. So I have moms who are raising two children who are living off of $14,000 a year. That's deep poverty. So, you know, those are issues that are extremely important. And when you look at something as massive as poverty, all of those other things play in. Crime, education, mass incarceration, all of those things play into, you know, poverty. It's like, you know, poverty is like the overarching issue, but all of these things have play a very big role in them. So, you know, while I have folks living in $5 million homes, I still have 25%, one in four people in my district living in poverty.
Wow. So, and, you know, and a lot of times, you know, poverty really becomes a death sentence over the course of time, because it affects healthcare and the access to healthcare as well, too. You know, we had a podcast, you know, regarding access to healthcare and, you know, the affordability of it. You know, if you're only making, you know, $16,000 a year, I mean, it's really, really hard to, you know, to get healthcare. It's almost impossible. It's almost impossible.
Well, not only that, I mean, poor people pay, in my opinion, poor people pay more than people who have the resources. I mean, typically, if you're poor, you have bad credit, and you're able to finance anything, your interest rate is going to be more than a person who has more money and is able to pay their things on time, and therefore they have a better credit score. Poor people, a lot of them are living in neighborhoods that are food deserts. So, you know, you wonder why, you know, mom is going to McDonald's. Well, it's easy to, you know, go and give your kids $3 and they can get a burger, fries, and a soda from McDonald's.
Right.
You know
right.
what I mean? People don't talk about it from that perspective, but that's actually what's happening. I mean, almost every fast food restaurant you know has a dollar menu. And
right.
those restaurants are a lot of times, and I'm poor in the city. So when I can't, when I don't have enough to go to the supermarket, or when I've been generationally poor, therefore I don't have the know-how to do some of these things, it's much easier to send my child to the corner store with $2-3 and they can get a couple chicken wings and a hug or something like that.
Right.
And that's what a lot of our young people are eating, and then that causes a lot of health disparities. So, you know, a lot of that is going into this big, you know, kind of category that is poverty.
A lot of times when you talk about the, you know, the generational type of behaviors and the generational type of, you know, wealth issues and poverty issues, you know, a lot of times the criminal justice system has, you know, put, you know, placed people in a position, you know, to where they can't recover either. It's like, you know, when people, you know, pay their debt to society, it's like they're, you know, they're paying for the rest of their lives. And you were, you know, part of a bill that, based on, you know, what I've read and what I've heard you speak about, is going to hopefully turn some of that around. You know, HB 1419, if I'm not mistaken. And I wanted, yes. I wanted you to talk about the, you know, the genesis of that particular bill, the intentions of the bill and how you became involved with it. And, also, you know, if you can speak about the long range impact that you feel that it will have on your state, you know, we definitely want to hear that.
Sure. So the genesis, for a lot for this to me, have come from the fact that, you know, we didn't just start here. 1419 has gotten a lot of good publicity since we passed it, but that wasn't actually the beginning. I mean, you know, in 2016, the governor signed Act Number 5 of 2016 into law, which did misdemeanor twos and threes that are of a nonviolent nature, and we created a process in Pennsylvania called limited access. And what limited access basically is that it seals a person's record so that only law enforcement would be able to see it. So if you went to court and got an order of limited access, when you go and apply for a job and ask if you can be convicted of something, if you've been given an order of limited access against that conviction, your answer would be no. And when they ran your record, it would not show up. Now, on the flip side, should somebody reoffend, the district attorney and the court would still have access to those documents. So that's actually where my work in criminal justice started, with the first piece of legislation that we got done in 16.
Okay.
This year, and then after that, if I can keep going, after 16 and 17, we got the governor to sign an executive order banning the box on all state level jobs, with the exception of those that where it's required by law. So basically, for most jobs, when you are applying now at a state level, it no longer asks you in the first round, have you ever been convicted of a crime?
Okay.
So that was 2016, Act Number 5, 2017, was banned a box. And then in 2018, this year is when we did the Clean Slate Bill. And what the Clean Slate Bill does is it combines two things. One, it takes the M2s and M3s that are of a nonviolent nature. After 10 years, it automatically seals those on your record.
Okay.
Which that automatic sealing is the first of its kind in the nation, where after a certain period of time, these crimes automatically go off your record.
Okay.
Which is a big deal in a sense that, you know, somebody could want to get that off their record, and lawyers could charge you $500, $750, $1,000 to do that process. But now we're doing it as a government automatically. So M2s, M3s, 10 years automatically. M1s, which are our misdemeanor ones, you have to go to court and you can get an order of limited access to seal those on your record. So
okay. For
all nonviolent misdemeanors, we've now provided a pathway to get those things sealed off of your record. So either it happens automatically and or you have to go to court and get it sealed. But beyond that, what a lot of people didn't know in Pennsylvania is that if you were arrested and the charges were dropped or they never prosecuted you, in Pennsylvania, your arrest record was something that could be pulled as well. Those things stayed on your record.
Okay.
So not only did we do the order of limited access for M2s and the automatic expungement for M2s and M3s and order of limited access for ones, but we also cleaned up people's arrest records. So after 3 years, if there's a charge and there's no court date, the district attorney's office is not prosecuting on it, all of those things are sealed on your record as well.
Right. Okay, that's major, man. So I guess you're hoping that, giving hope to, these people who have offended in this nature, perhaps that it can cut down on some of the recidivism that you would probably see, with those, small time type of, offenses. How does it affect, nonviolent felonies and things like that? Is there anything in place for that?
So, yes and no. Does it affect it directly? No. Are there some things that indirectly will affect it? Yes. The indirect piece is that a lot of the folks who are going for pardons for the M2s, M3s, and M1s will no longer have to go through the pardon process. They'll be able to go through this other process that we've now created.
Right.
Which means that the Board of Pardons should really only be dealing with folks who have felonies, which will help speed up the process for a person getting a pardon. According to our lieutenant governor, who's the chair of the Board of Pardons, he believes that it'll cut the time for a person to get a pardon by 25%.
Okay.
Which, if you've already been down for 7 years and you're trying to get employed, you don't want to wait another 2 years, so cutting that time by 25% is a benefit to those folks. But more importantly, I think what we're doing for those with felonies is we're taking a step approach to getting there. When I first got to the legislature, I wanted to do felonies. In 2013, my first bill that I introduced had felonies included. But I was told that the General Assembly wasn't ready to do it yet. So we did it incrementally. We did M2s and M3s in 2016.
Right.
This year, we did all misdemeanors in 2018. My goal is to go back next session and to look at the nonviolent felonies and see what we can get passed and get to the governor's desk around nonviolent felonies. In Pennsylvania, should we do that, we will be affecting between 1 to 1.5 million Pennsylvanians.
And that would be extraordinary. And I would think that legislature would be interested in considering something like that, primarily because if it's cutting down on the time, then obviously there's going to be a little bit more time for consideration, and you know, you won't just, you know, be flying through them. You know, you have opportunity to really give a hard look at some of those you know, felony charges. Also, it would seem like that if you can get people back into the workforce, because it's a major stumbling block for a lot of individuals to obtain work, you know, because of their record. If you can get people back into the workforce, it's going to expand your tax base, and it's going to give the city and the state more money, right?
Well, I look at it from a holistic approach. I mean, one, you can cut down on recidivism, which means that we can cut down on our prison spending,
right,
which I think we're far overdue for. To their credit, our governor and our Secretary of Corrections has been working to reduce our prison population while we remain safe. But beyond that, I mean, we talked about poverty. Criminal justice reform has a lot to do with poverty. When you look at, and I don't have any scientific data, and I actually wish researchers would look at this, but I do have anecdotal evidence just from working in the field. When you look at a lot of people who live in poverty, a lot of them have criminal records. And even if the person living in poverty doesn't have a criminal record, they usually are affiliated with a person that has a criminal record. Well, what do I mean by that? You look at a sister who's out here, a woman out here who may have two or three children. And if you ask her, a lot of times when they're living in poverty, it's because they don't have the second income. And why don't they have the second income? A lot of times because the child's father has a criminal record. You know what I mean? So it's like when you look at the intersection of mass incarceration and what it has done to our families, getting people back to work helps solve a lot of problems.
It really does.
It helps solve with your crime, because now you're putting fathers back into the household. You're putting families back together. It helps with our tax base because you're getting people back to work. It helps with our poverty numbers, because now a lot of these, you know, one family households become two income households, because the second person is now eligible to work. And that's men and women. I mean, I go to some of our female prisons and I see a lot of the women locked up. They're coming home and a lot of them have children waiting for them.
Right.
So the question becomes, what kind of employment will that mom with three children who has a felony on her record, what kind of employment is she going to be able to get so that she can take care of those children? So it's all interwoven. It all intersects. And it's one of the reasons why I really call criminal justice reform the liberation movement of our time. Because if we are able to help people seriously reintegrate into society, if we're able to help them fix their criminal records, we will actually be on the pathway to liberating people from the chains of poverty, or liberating people from the chains of mass incarceration, liberating families from generational poverty, and a whole lot of other things.
Right, right. And, you know, I always say, man, that, you know, this whole, you know, mass incarceration thing, you know, whether you believe it came from, you know, racist initiatives or anything like that, regardless of how you believe, it's really, as a whole, it's bad for business. There's so much money that is not being made because of the fact that there's a whole section of our community that is really unable to work. It's just horrible for business. Moving on to you know, some of the other things that you're doing, are there any other committees or any other legislative initiatives that you're involved in? And if you are, what is the projected impact of those initiatives? Because I'm, you know, I see some of the stuff that you're posting, and you're really busy. You're out there, you're doing things, and you're really trying to impact the community. What else have we got going on?
I'm very big on education reform, looking how we reform our education system. I think a lot of that starts with Pennsylvania putting up more resources for public education. But I'm also very big on how we spend that money and the modalities by which we do deliver education to our young people. Another thing that we're looking at is policing and how we do policing in Pennsylvania. You know, currently there is no real oversight for police in Pennsylvania, as there are for other industries. If you're a doctor and you have a certain amount of lawsuits against you or claims against you, That stuff follows you. That's in your record. The medical board has that.
Right.
If you're a nurse, the medical board has that. You know, if you're a business owner, you know, we have different bureaus that keep that type of information.
Right.
But if you're a police officer and you're fired for excessive force from one department, you can go to another department. Pennsylvania has hundreds of police departments. Hundreds of them. I was out in Allegheny County, which the largest city in Allegheny County is Pittsburgh. There's over 100 police departments just in that one county.
Wow.
For your listeners, let me explain what that means. Philadelphia, as a city, has 1.6 million people. We have one police department, the Philadelphia Police Department. Right outside Philadelphia, though, is Upper Darby. They have a police department. You know, then you have Darby. They have a police department. You have Sharon Hill and all of these other small towns. All of these different towns, many of them have their own individual police department, where it may only be 10 officers or 15 officers, you know, but they all have their own police department. So if you get fired from one police department for excessive force, you just pick up and go to another one. If you get fired from Philadelphia, that doesn't preclude you from going to work in Upper Darby or in Darby PD. That doesn't preclude you from going to Chester PD. That doesn't, you know, preclude you from going to Reading and any other place that has a police department. So you could have an officer who has a track record and a history of excessive force, but because they've never been prosecuted criminally, they're just jumping around to different police departments. So what we're looking at, you know, how do you build trust back in the community? Well, the first way you do it is you create some type of oversight where when an officer is being hired, we're able to check their background, not just their criminal background, but their work history to see, have you done this? Have you had issues in other police departments? And the way you do that is by creating some type of oversight board and things of that nature. So we're looking at how do we do policing differently. And we're also looking at bringing all of the players to the table and just look at, you know, what can we do differently with regards to policing in Pennsylvania. So, you know, we have a lot of things going on. I'm also looking at some things around housing and funding for building more affordable housing. We have a very bad gentrification problem in my district and throughout the city of Philadelphia. And if we don't get a hold on it, you're not going to see a lot of working class people being able to afford to live in Philadelphia. So, you know, we're looking at, you know, partnerships to do more affordable housing and quite honestly, affordable rentals, because, you know, there are a lot of people who are just not in a position to buy a home, but they need a place to live as well, and they need to be affordable.
Right, right. Let's go back to this oversight of the law enforcement area there. Mm-hmm. So just so I'm clear, and just so that, you know, other people can be clear that are listening, you're talking about perhaps making a review board per se, or are you saying that individuals should have to be licensed? Are we talking about licensure here to where, you know, you have to have a license to be a law enforcement officer, and it has to maybe be you know, renewed every so often, or it can be suspended so that way you can't hop from one to the other? Is that the type of thought process that's going on with that type of initiative?
All of the above. You know, we're talking about creating a board that can do reviews, but we're also talking about a board that has oversight that provides licenses. Absolutely.
Okay.
If you're providing policing in Pennsylvania, the only license you need should not be about carrying a firearm.
Right.
You know, there should be a statewide standard that is required to have a license to provide policing. Listen, if you are a law enforcement officer in the state of Pennsylvania, that means that you can detain someone and take their freedom from them. It means that you walk around with an instrument on your hip that can take their life. There has to be oversight and some type of standard for that, because the standard for Philadelphia Police Department may be different than the standard for the Reading Police Department, which will be different from the standard from the state police, which will be different from the Cranberry Township Police. You know,
all of those
standards are different. We need a state standard. We need a state license. And we need a way for us to keep track of who has done what and what's going on with policing in Pennsylvania.
All right. So what type of what type of opposition do you anticipate? Would it be something that police unions would push back on? Would it be something that each individual county could possibly push back on? Who would be the opponents to this, and what would you think their reasoning would be to even, you know, put up any type of opposition to this? Have you thought that far ahead on it?
Well, I mean, this initiative is something being led by one of my colleagues out in the West.
Okay.
I represented, actually, several of my colleagues, represented Jake Wheatley, Ed Gainey, and Austin Davis, and we're, as chairman of the Black Caucus, we're playing a very strong supportive role. But, you know, we are in the beginning stages of looking at this, but I'm absolutely sure that there's going to be a lot of pushback, probably from the FOP and, you know, other law enforcement, you know, unions. But, you know, it's one of the reasons why, you know, my approach has always been to bring people to the table in the beginning so that they are part of the conversation instead of coming up with something and just laying it on people. And then people, you know, come up with their own reasons to oppose it.
Right.
I'm not trying to make a point. I'm not trying to make a statement. I try to make law. And when you're trying to make law, I think you have to have all of the stakeholders at the table so that you don't, you know, just come up with anything.
Right. And that's good to know. And that is a great initiative. We'll definitely be keeping our eyes out for that. And I'm sure you'll keep us updated as those things start to move forward. Because it sounds, number one, it sounds challenging, but number two, it sounds like that it could be beneficial long term. And I know that sometimes, you know, passing laws and doing things like that, it's kind of like turning a cruise ship on a dime. You know, it's pretty close to impossible sometimes. But you know, we'll definitely be on the lookout for that. But let's talk about some of your long range, you know, political goals. I mean, do you have any personal goals?
Listen, I thank God for His grace and mercy for waking me up every day and giving me the strength to do the work that I'm able to do. What I'm focused on is continuing to do the work that I'm doing in the House of Representatives in Pennsylvania. You know, do I have ideas on what I would like to do long range? Probably. But, you know, what I will say is this. Any and everything that you'll ever hear me doing politically will be about the empowerment and the liberation of people. And how do we balance the playing field so that everybody has a shot to do all of the things that they want to do? And not just in words, but how do we do that and actually, you know, fix this establishment and the structure? Because a lot of times, you know, we come up with all of these programs, but when the program goes away, so does the opportunity. We have to fix the structure so that the structure isn't disadvantaging people. So, you know, I don't make predictions on where I'm going or what I'm doing politically, but I can tell you this, wherever I'm at, it's going to be about the empowerment and liberation of people.
Okay. All right. So, are you into mentoring or anything like that? I mean, do you spend time, you know, trying to, you know, impart a little bit of wisdom, you know, to the younger generation? And if you do, you know, what words of wisdom would you offer, you know, to a young person who wanted to get into politics or just try to, you know, impact their community, you know, in a positive way?
First of all, I don't think I'm old enough or have done enough at times to provide any inspiration or mentorship to anybody. And it's still a humbling, no, I mean it. It is still a humbling experience for me, for anybody to ask me my advice on how to do it. But I do understand where I am in life. And it's just crazy to me because I can still remember high school. You know, I can still remember being an intern myself in high school in an elected official's office. And to, you know, be where we are today, it still makes me take a step back and you know, just relish in the blessings that have been bestowed upon me and my team and all the folks that I work with to help get this stuff done. So you know, I got to take a step back. Like I was on Instagram last night and there was a young guy that was like, I want to be just like you.
Wow, that's heavy. That's heavy, man.
I'm just like, what? Like, dude, I'm over here trying to trying to clean up my room and you know, put my stuff in my laundry bin and just try to keep my house organized. Like,
right.
I'm over here, you know, I'm over here struggling, trying to keep it all together myself. But, you know, to see a high school student look at me as a person that they want to be, I mean, when you think about that, it's humbling, but it's also a responsibility.
Right, right.
And I wear that responsibility every day. So to answer the long answer to your short question is yes. When folks do reach out, I do provide mentorship. I've been blessed to have lots of interns work in my office. I have an intern working in my office now. So I always provide, when people reach out and say, can I intern in your office? Absolutely. You can come on down. And if you're willing to work, we'll provide you with an opportunity to be an intern. Because, I started as an intern.
Right,
I was an intern in somebody's office, and now I hold an elected office myself. So, yes, I do provide internships, and I do mentor. I do go out and talk to a lot of young people across the panel, across the country, actually across the world. I mean, I've been blessed to be in a lot of different places. But when you ask me for my words of wisdom, whenever a young person asks me how to get involved in politics, I say the first thing is to do something. Find something that you feel that you can be involved in and do something. Far too often, I see people running for a political office because it's the right time, it's the right moment, they're riding a wave, and they've never really done anything.
And
I get it, but if you're going to be committed to the work and not just the office, that commitment has to start with you actually doing something. So if that's something as simple as you going to your local middle school or whatever and reading to young people, if that means you providing tutoring services to young people, that means you being a coach for your local sports team, if that means you being on the advisory board for your local rec center, anything, just do something. Start. Be involved. Be a part of the process.
Right.
And
right.
Then the other thing is, I say educate yourself. A lot of people get involved in politics and run for office and have absolutely no clue what they're running for, what they're doing. Like, I always find it funny when folks are running for one office, like you're running for a state office and you're talking about Social Security. I mean, Social Security is important to me.
Right.
But I'm a state legislator. I have absolutely nothing to do with Social Security. I cannot affect Social Security as a state official.
Right.
So when people do that, you know, it shows to me that they're not prepared.
Right.
So, you know, I say start off by doing something. And then the second thing is to educate yourself. And then the third thing I would say is find something bigger than you. I mean, I don't know, Christian, Muslim, Jew, whatever, whoever you believe in, or if you don't believe in any deity. But, you know, there has to be a desire to do something that's bigger than just you. You know, the work that I do for me is never about me. Like, I don't have a criminal record. Thank God I've never been to the jailhouse. And the only time I've been in court is because I typically know the judge and I'm hanging out, and I have an interest in it. But, you know, I've never had to go through those situations. But it's bigger than me. It's about those around me and how the system affects those folks. So, you know, that would be my advice to young people.
Okay. Well, you know, when we get guests on the show, we typically like to ask them, you know, something that is either business related or culture, you know, Black culture related, mm-hmm. Or both. And I want to ask you about supporting Black businesses. Do you feel that it's important that that our community and other communities actually, you know, support Black businesses? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, absolutely. I tell people all the time, I'm unapologetically Black. And what I mean by that is that it's not that I don't like other. I just start my love with Philadelphia, my love with America, my love with the world starts with first my love of my people. And I think that, you know, people feel like there's something wrong with that. It's not. I want the rising tide to lift all boats, yes. But I gotta help those boats that are closest to me first.
Right.
And that starts with supporting those businesses, folks that are in our community and from our community and things of that nature. So, you know, and here's the funny thing. I tell people all the time, a lot of times it's not even about you going out of your way to do things. For example, when I'm in Harrisburg, there are a lot of times where, you know, organizations or associations will organize different dinners because they want to talk to legislators about different issues that they may have. Well, that's fine. But if you're talking to me, if you're talking to the Black Caucus, you're 9 times out of 10, you're going to be doing so at a Black establishment.
Right.
It only makes sense.
Yeah,
you know, there's
it makes sense.
Establishments going on.
Right, right.
But if we're going to talk and we're going to have a meal, we're going to have a meal at a Black establishment. When I do fundraisers and all that kind of stuff to raise political dollars and whatnot, I do it at African-American establishments. When I hang out with my friends and I go out to eat and whatnot, I try to start at African-American establishments. And does that mean I don't go other places? No, I do. But I make a conscious effort to spend my dollars in my community. And I don't see anything wrong with that. You know, now, am I one of those folks that say, you know, 100% of what I... No, I'm not saying that. Because I do like other things. But, you know, when it's a Thursday night and I'm going to go hang out and have a beverage with some friends, we're going to try to find an establishment where we can help circulate that money in our community. And I just think everybody should do that, you know.
Right.
You know, when I'm in my Asian constituents, like I love Vietnamese food. I love it.
Oh, right? Man, me too, man. So me too.
So when I go into my Vietnamese homies, there's always Vietnamese people in there eating. Always. Because they're supporting their community. They're supporting their culture.
Right.
We got to get in the same habit.
In the same habit.
There's nothing
exactly
wrong with it.
There's absolutely nothing wrong with it. And our show is a big proponent of supporting Black businesses. We speak on it all the time. The second question that I have for you, man, it's a cultural question, man. Are you a hip hop fan?
Sure.
Are you a hip hop fan?
I am.
All right. Yeah. So before we let you go, man, I need your top 5 MCs, 5 to 1.
Wow. This is difficult because I believe these kind of questions are also generational.
Okay.
So, I don't know if I could do 5 to 1. Here's what I can do. I can give you my top 5. I don't want to rank them.
Man, come on, man. Come on. Hey, look,
nah,
look.
I don't
we...
want to get in trouble. Hey, somebody's going to find it 10 years from now and going to try to clown me for
right.
number 1 and number 3.
So look, we I did 10 to 1. We did 10 to 1, so you can do 5 to 1. Come on now.
So, all right, listen. I'm in my top 5. No particular order.
Okay.
I'm gonna give you
the top 5. Okay. All right.
Got to put Biggie in there.
Okay.
I'm putting Jay-Z in there.
Okay.
Tupac.
Okay.
KRS-One.
Okay.
And here's the thing. Before Donald Trump, I would have put Kanye West in there.
Oh, really?
I would have. And let me explain why.
Okay.
Kanye, for years, has been one of the most creative MCs out there. I mean, from the way he was doing his videos to his lyrics. Like, if you actually listen to some of the earlier Kanye West stuff, it was very, very, very conscious. And I'm very, very much into people who have a message
right
what they're saying.
Right. Yeah, we are too, man. We are too.
That brother than lost his mind. So I can't do it. And
okay.
This is going to shock you.
Okay.
Most Def.
Oh, no, that's not shocking at all. We had him on... I think some honorable mention list or something like that. But yeah, Mos Def is nice, man. That's a
see, Mos Def is not your pop culture radio hit guy.
Right.
But for me, because I'm interested in what you're saying, I'm Mos Def.
Right. Okay. All right, man. So
I think that's a decent list.
It's a decent list, man. And like I said, I got you by a few years, so I'm gonna allow the 90s type of thing you got going on there. I'm gonna allow that because I got you by about 15 years.
So. I told you.
You said it was generational.
You kind of listen, generational.
Right, it was generational.
They
it was generational. Right, right.
Like, listen, my chief of staff got me by 10 years.
Okay.
His list is going to be different than mine. Now, let me say this, though. Let me say this. I also got to see, it's hard to do the top five because I don't want to forget my sister, like MC Light.
Right.
I think Queen Latifah could definitely be in the mix as well.
Right.
Because, you know, I look at the lyricists as how influential their music has become to the culture as well.
Right.
And the fact that MC Light is still touring and still giving her music, the fact that Queen Latifah took her music and made it cultural.
Right.
She got to be on these lists too. Because UNITY was more than just a song.
Right,
became
it was a call.
Cultural influence. Yeah. Here's the thing. And then they took that and they played that into TV with Living Single. Because when you look at Living Single, the TV show, it was a whole different concept than what you had been seeing on TV before.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? So, right. I believe a lot of that was spawned from her liberation music.
Right, exactly. You're exactly right. Well, if you get the opportunity, man, listen to our top 10 MCs episode. I think that you will enjoy that. I've said it 100 times, man. This particular conversation starts more arguments than dice games. It really does. You got a good list though. You got a good list. You got a good list.
Thank you.
So but I will say there are no Philly rappers on that list though, man. How's that gonna fly around the way?
See, that's why I don't want to do a list. Because and here's the funny thing. I do a street festival every year in my district. And a part of the festival is a music concert. I mean, we've had great, I've had Big Daddy Kane, Kool Moe Dee, MC Light perform. We've had Biz Markie, DJ Kool. We've had R&B folks like Drew Hill and Jasmine Sullivan, Kendrick the Family Soul and Total. We've had all of them perform. Actually, I think that's a better question people aren't putting out. Your top R&B group or artist. Like, that's a list. Those are lists that we don't actually talk about.
We got it coming though, man. We got a show on that coming up, so you'll be able to hear that coming up soon. We got
all right. That's something we don't talk about. But we've had all those folks, and this year we call it the Homecoming Edition.
Okay.
We had Beanie Siegel, Freeway, Kristen Neve, Petey. I had Major Figure. I had Tough Crew, Schoolie D. You know, you had an all Philly cast. And definitely also a lot of hip hop from Philly, some Philly new hip hop artists and some of our classics. So, I mean, I would say, Will Smith is clearly him and Jazzy Jeff are at the top. But then when you talk about like straight hip hop rap, like straight up rap,
right?
I mean, Beanie Siegel may still be one of the best.
He's a beast. He's a beast. And you know what, man? Since we're on the conversation of culture, and after this, I'm gonna let you get on about your day because I know that that you're definitely busy. But you know, Philadelphia, you know, there's a whole sound. Philadelphia has its own sound when it comes to soul music, R&B.
Yeah.
It was dominant. Over a whole particular area, the music that came out of Philadelphia. So, if there are any music historians out there, do your research. You know, Philadelphia has always been strong on music.
Here's an interesting fact. One of the leaders in that is Kenny Gamble. He's founded the Phillips Sound of Music, Gamble and Huff.
Right, right.
Kenny Gamble lives in my district.
Wow.
He does.
He's a legend.
If you were here, I could take you right there.
He's a legend. That duo is a legend, man. You can't even count the hits that they've written. You can't count them.
So, I'll tell you a real quick story there, and then I'll go.
Okay.
Because I think you may enjoy this. So, I actually have a good relationship with Kenny Gamble and his wife, Fox and Gamble. Great people. Literally just great, genuine people. And Kenny's been doing a lot of good stuff around affordable housing and education here in Philadelphia. And as I said, Kenny and Foxmore live in my district and are my constituents. I was sitting at an event that Foxmore has. She does it every year called Style and Grace. And it's a fashion show fundraiser for some of the schools that they run. And it's really nice. So you have people from all over who are in the show. The food is typically provided by culinary programs at the schools that they run. And I'm sitting at the table with Kenny Gamble, and all of this different music is playing, and one of his songs, Come On, I Love Music, comes off.
Okay.
So I said to him, Brother Gamble, I said, do you remember how and when a lot of your songs were written? He was like, yeah. So I'm like, okay, this one, I Love Music. Tell me how it came about. He's like, oh, well, me and Huff, we were in the studio one day, and this is how he's talking. It's so serious. He's like, me and Huff were in the studio one day, and I turned to Huff, and I said, you know what, Huff? I love music. he said Huff got on the piano, and Huff caught up with a tune, and next thing you know, he had a hit record. I love music. And I'm just sitting there like, this is the coolest thing ever.
That is the coolest thing, yep.
Who is one of the music's greatest, and he's telling me that he wrote this song because he was just sitting in the studio and he said, I love music. And that's how the song came about.
Right. And that song is what, maybe 40 something years old now?
Easily.
You put it on today and it still goes off, man. That's classic.
It's still a rock.
Yeah.
It's still a rock.
Right. Yep. So that's classic music. And, we need to get back to making that, man. So, before you go, man, if there are any parting words that you want to give our listeners, politically, socially, what do you want people to take away, from this particular conversation? Or is there anything that we haven't covered that people need to know about Jordan Harris?
No, man, listen, like I said, a lot of what I try to look at myself as, just a piece on this chessboard. Just a soldier trying to get some stuff done in this war. But the reality for me is that we all have a part to play. And, what I tell people all the time is that, you need to be a part of the process. And a lot of folks will say, oh, I don't need to vote. Nothing ever changes. And, I want our people of color, to stop with the voter fatigue. A lot of other people don't have that. And I made this analogy the other day. I said, listen, if I go to a barber, and he keeps pushing my hairline back. Or for sister to go to a beautician.
Right.
She keeps messing up her hair.
Right.
You don't stop going to the barbershop. You don't stop going to the beautician.
Right.
You just get a new barber.
Right.
The same thing happens with elected officials. If your folks aren't doing what you need them to do, you don't just stop voting altogether. You vote for somebody different. Because the reality is this. Whether you vote or not, you're voting. You're silent. Is also your vote.
Exactly.
There's going to be a president. There's going to be members of Congress. There's going to be members of the United States House and Senate. There's going to be members of General Assemblies throughout the country. There's going to be governors and mayors and so on and so forth. The question becomes, will we as a people have a voice and who those folks are? So for me, look, in 2013, when we were doing criminal justice reform work, the governor at the time said he wouldn't sign the bill. Therefore, the bill didn't move. Fast forward, we got a new governor. This governor said he would sign those bills. And we got bills to his desk, and we changed the law. And those things are helping people. That's why elections matter. That's exactly why elections matter. So, educate yourself on who's running, and, then get out there and be a part of the process. And not just vote. Be engaged after election day. Email your elected officials. Call their offices. Show up at their offices. Go out to the community. Community is not about being hands-off. It's about being hands-on.
I just want to thank you for being on the show today. Again, the work that you've done thus far has been totally extraordinary. The people of the 186th district in Philadelphia, they're blessed to have you. And, you know, they're blessed to be able to have someone that is working in their favor with the passion and the drive that you have. If you ever need, you know, any type of other platform to discuss any type of initiatives, you know, you have our information. We're more than happy to, you know, to help you put it out there. And, you know, we appreciate you being on the show today.
Thank you so much.
And we out.
I could be wrong, but I doubt it. So don't enter this debate if you ain't about it. Reflection and introspect. Make sure that you come correct, and you should probably hurry. It gets crowded. Bring a friend with you. I could be wrong, but I doubt it. Don't enter this debate if you ain't about it. Reflection and introspect. Make sure that you come correct, and you should hurry up. It might get crowded. Bring a friend with you. Expression Reds, their curators are cool. The culture and consciousness brought directly to you. Tune in every week for the newest of new and occasional politics as it pertains to you. Divergent point of views make for a whole picture, and we suggest you get your money up and take the shit with you. Ain't no fountain to you, but it's a secret elixir to ensure the black man as a permanent fixture. Standing here in America behind enemy lines, where more often than not my skin's considered a crime. Cops kill us daily and will never do time, while a crooked ass judge decides to fate for mine. One day at a time is what my mama would say. And since mama said living ain't no time to play, and since I got a little game, I'ma give it away. But let's start the show before I get carried away. I could be wrong, but I doubt it. So don't enter this debate if you ain't about it. Reflection and introspect. Make sure that you come correct, and you should probably hurry. It gets crowded. Bring a friend with you. I could be wrong, but I doubt it. Don't enter this debate if you ain't about it. Reflection and introspect. Make sure that you come correct, and you should hurry up. It might get crowded. Bring a friend with you.
You just tuned in to I Could Be Wrong, But I Doubt It, hosted by Fresh and Reg. Holla back next week.